ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife history.
Much of the study of history involves digging, that is, archaeological excavation. That's what archaeologists do. They dig. Until relatively recently, being an archaeologist in Australia meant mainly heading off to digs overseas, probing ancient ruins. Also bringing objects back to Australia to allow for further research and teaching and investigation. There was probably a mistaken belief that there was nothing to dig for in Australia. Sydney University is Australia's oldest university, had seen collections build since the 19th century, but particularly since the 1960s, when the teaching of archaeology began in earnest. Now, most of the museum-quality items that the university held were put into the Chow Chak Wing Museum, which opened in 2020, incorporating the Nicholson Collection, the Maclay Collections, and the university's art collection. But other items had been stored haphazardly, vulnerable to theft and damage, and with thousands of archaeological artefacts from sites across Australia and also the Mediterranean, stored in a gardener's shed, a former nursing building, and scattered locations around the uni's campus. A few years ago, archaeologist Andrew Wilson was employed as the archaeological collections registrar at the universities to find, organise, and gather together all these prized archaeological items. He joins us this evening. Andrew, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you.
I guess you've got all sorts of stuff there.
We do. Yes, the range is quite broad.
Yeah. Because it's true, isn't it? From archaeology hasn't been an organised science for all that long, actually. I mean, and particularly the notion of the dig, that is to dig in a systematic manner rather than just having a look. And for a long time it's been plagued, not is that the right word, plagued by hobbyists and collectors who just pick up stuff, not knowing what it is. And it's sort of disappeared into all sorts of places, including, I suppose, the university.
Yes. I mean, what we might refer to as scientific archaeology, in a broad sense, it is from the later 19th century and onwards. And, of course, in this century and recently, it's become much more sophisticated and much more exacting in the way it deals with things.
Yeah, no, precisely. I mean, but the idea of the really organised dig where you map it out and then, you know, carefully, and you understand where you are in time digging through it, of course, is relatively recent.
Isn't it? Yeah. It is.
You've got all sorts of stuff, including stuff from academics and students who went to the Mediterranean. And here we go. They're not exactly the Elgin marbles, but hey, they brought a lot of stuff back because you could.
And because that was the, I mean, let's be frank, the concept was that Australia didn't have anything that was worthy of archaeological investigation.
That's what we thought, yeah. Mm.
And so you went to sites in the old world and brought stuff back so that museums could have displays and students to civilize the public and to teach students how to be old world archaeologists.
Well, that's right, because it's all tied up, I guess, with the cultural notions of the time that Greek and Roman civilizations were the beginning of time, and so we needed to know more about them. And if we were, as a young country, to join the world, we needed to know more about Greece and Rome. And we failed to neglect that our own civilizations here in this country were older. But anyway, that's another matter, I suppose. So you've ended up, therefore, with a whole lot of items from the Mediterranean, including the Pella items. Tell me about these.
The Professor of Near Eastern, or what we might now call West Asian archaeology, Basil Hennessy, started working at Pella in 1977, I think, and his aim, as he said, was to bring back as much material for study and for museums as he could. It's a very long settlement site, and so it presented a whole series of opportunities to examine all kinds of material from the Byzantine to, and Islamic period right back to the New Stone Age.
Yeah. Look, I mean, in this, ethically at the time, there wasn't any regard for these things, were you? I mean, we know that Lord Elgin, for example, stole the stuff, I mean, quite blatantly pinched it, and he knew he was pinching it too. I mean, he wasn't doing it for any scientific purpose either. He was trying to make some cash. But in these instances here, there were countries where these things were picked up had pretty lax regulatory requirements, or they were ignored anyway, weren't they?
Yes. Of course, that isn't the case now.
No.
It's generally unacceptable to souvenir things, and that kind of approach, in some ways, the easiest way to mark that change is Greece in the 1830s, mm-hmm. before Greece actually became a nation state, while it was still collecting bits off the French and British empires, and of course off the Ottoman Empire. It passed the sort of nascent National Assembly passed a resolution saying that all cultural material in Greece was the property of the Greek state and couldn't be exported. And that's, of course, partly in a response to Elgin's.
Yeah, well, exactly. And, you know, Australians would feel the same, in fact, do feel the same about what's happened with the plunder of important Aboriginal artefacts, you know, including the... shall we mention the shield again? But but I mean, you know, you only have to think for a second about how we would feel about it in reverse to understand where that's coming from. But still, nevertheless, these were scientists, I guess, in some cases scientists too, are these early archaeologists going for legitimate intents. They brought stuff back, and what happened to it?
Well, it's been used and studied by students and by researchers. Not all of it, though. And so there's a sense in which there's a significant potential to do more work, and that's one of the reasons for managing it properly. Another reason for managing it properly is that although you can't export this kind of material from Jordan, in this case, anymore, we have a responsibility to look after the material that we have on their behalf. And currently we're doing a project in Greece. And as I said, that's famously the first country who says, no, you can't export cultural material. We could bring back samples for analysis, but you can't bring back archaeological material in bulk. And so all our work is done in Greece. And the information that we generate from that belongs to the Greek state.
Is there any feeling that maybe this stuff should be crated up and sent back? Or do they even want it back?
Well, if it was to be sent back, they would then have the problem of dealing
with it. What to do with it.
Yes. And we can look after it here. We can make use of it here.
Yeah.
We probably wouldn't do the same thing again. But on the other hand, it does provide an opportunity to do further work. Most excavations of that type in West Asia now start with a plan for what to do with what's recovered, which is different from the plan that Basil Hennessy elucidated when he started.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? So your job was to clean up the shed, pretty much, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. And the shed had lots of different things in it, and the shed had moved again and again. As I mean, the collections were never neglected as such, because academics and researchers and students were using them, but they were never consolidated, and they were never really understood to have the significant value that we now recognise. So when a space became available, it was used to store this material, and then when someone said, oh, no, we're going to reconfigure that building and it will become something else, then another empty available space was found, and that process happened a number of times until they ended up in a partly disused building on the Cumberland campus at Lidcombe, which I refer to as the gardener's shed. It was basically a complex of buildings that the groundsman used for all of their kinds of things, but it was a perfectly good storage space.
Okay. I'm speaking with Andrew Wilson. He's got the delightful title of the Archaeological Collections Registrar at the Sydney University School of Humanities, and basically he's responsible for a whole lot of stuff that the university's accumulated over the years from Greece and Jordan, but importantly also from Australia too. I mean, you've got stuff from Wybalina, one of the saddest places in Australian history, possibly, on Flinders Island, where the last remaining Tasmanian Aboriginal people were exiled to. You've got stuff from Elizabeth Farm at Parramatta, Hyde Park Barracks?
Not from Hyde Park Barracks.
Okay.
We have a close relationship with Museums of History in New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And so students from Sydney University have done research on the Hyde Park Barracks material.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier this year, we had a complete undergraduate course that was based on Elizabeth Farm. We have material from excavations from the 70s,
mm-hmm.
one of which I was on as an undergraduate. And so the students were able to go to the site, do mapping and survey and standard recording techniques that archaeologists use everywhere, and then come back to campus and look at the artefacts that had been excavated, classify them, describe them systematically, and record them and learn all the techniques that archaeologists now use in those kinds of situations.
We've learned how to dig in Australia too, haven't we? having looked around and thought, well, there's nothing to see here, we've actually realised there's quite a bit here. And with, 50 or 60,000 years of settlement by Aboriginal people, there's probably a lot under the ground, isn't there?
There is. And that nowadays has its own wonderful characteristics in that it's done completely in conjunction with communities, so that there's no sense that archaeologists come in to look at something. The process now is very much the community decides what it's interested in dealing with, and the archaeologists and conservators are there to be part of that process rather than to initiate the process themselves. And of course, the community then becomes involved in the outcomes, which might be scientific research papers, but it might also be methods of conserving rock art or ensuring that existing sites are protected and so on.
Mm. Yeah, on the mantelpieces of around Australia, there would be heaps of stuff, wouldn't there?
Oh, yes. Mm. And that's
stone tools.
That's reality.
Sharpened pieces of rock that had been deliberately used as tools.
Yes, and bits of broken china and other things that people
No bits of the Portuguese ship yet.
Not yet. And I'm sure there are maritime archaeologists who are pining for a bit of Portugal, but I suspect they will continue doing that for quite a long time.
I suspect they will as well. Well, good on you. I'm glad you must have a very inexhaustible marker pen, I assume.
Well, it's an exciting job. And now, of course, as things, even in archaeology, are increasingly digital, the challenges, the immediate challenges are to create digital records for all of this material and make it more easily available to researchers and to anyone else who's interested.
Yes, well, you look at what happened to written records, we think about Trove or something like the National Library and the difference that's made to researchers putting things online.
Yes.
The knowledge will explode as a result, you would imagine.
Mm. And, of course, Trove also, the Trove catalogue includes objects.
Oh, yes, it does too.
So it's possible to put selected archaeological objects onto Trove, and that's one of the things I wouldn't mind attempting.
What a job. Hey, terrific to talk with you as well. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.